Welcome to Trillo Talk. This is a podcast dedicated to topics that we think are important to the profession of medical writing. Our goal is to bring topical issues to the forefront and hopefully spark a conversation in a wider domain about these issues. I'm Lisa Chamberlain-James, and I'm delighted to be here today with Dr. Barry Dries. And we are going to have a lovely time talking about lay summaries and everything to do with writing for the general public and patients. Hi, Barry. Good to have you join me.
Thank you, Lisa. Nice to be here.
I know that you've got an awful lot of experience in both domains, both in writing for regulatory audiences and also in writing for the general public. So I wonder if you could kick us off by saying what you think are the main issues that writers face when we're swapping to a different audience, when we're writing for the general public.
Okay, thanks. I just want to say, though, that I think this is one of the most exciting developments in medical writing in a long time, because, and that leads me to the answer to your question, much of regulatory writing, which is mostly what we do at Trilogy, is involved in writing for the regulatory authorities for a very scientifically literate audience. And you tend to write in pretty much the same way, whether it's an investigator's brochure, a CSR protocol, PSUR, whatever. Now, however, all of a sudden, we regulatory writers are being asked to write for patients. And that's a whole different ball game. And what's interesting, I think, is it's not just making the language more accessible, although that's clearly important. Yeah. And I like to pitch it in kind of a pyramid. The bottom part is using plain language and writing things that patients can understand. That's what I call lay language. But then you have to consider the two upper levels. The next one is lay presentation, and we'll go into that. And then the top one is lay science. You know, some of these things that, of course, an FDA or an EMA reviewer would be well-versed in, a patient is not going to be well-versed in.
Absolutely. I think that that's laid it out beautifully. I think it's a great mistake. Most people just say, well, it's fine. I just translate this into simple language, which in itself is very difficult and has its own challenges, obviously. But I think writing a fit for purpose document for a non-specialist audience, and I think moving forwards for our sanity, we'll just say for the general public, but we're talking about anyone who's a non-specialist. I think it's way more than that. I think it's not just dumbing it down, which is one of my pet peeves. And if I had a penny for everyone who said, oh, well, it's fine, you just dumb it down, I think I would be lying on a beach with a cocktail right now. It's way more than that, as you say, very eloquently. And I think it is important to think beyond just the words that we're using. We need to think about how we are presenting the information and then think about how we put that into context. Human beings are very visual creatures, and I know, you know, we're going to get into the presentation a bit later on, but they are very crucial aspects. And I agree with you that the hardest point of all is trying to put all of that information into context so that the reader can make sense of the information that we're giving them. It's not just about giving somebody simpler information. It's allowing them and empowering them to make sensible decisions based on that information. There's no point just giving someone a load of information. The internet does that all the time. It's what you actually do with that information afterwards and how you process it and what you use it for.
Well, I would jump in already and say, going from writing for the general public with language, that's been done for a while in various ways and aspects. There are even several websites out there that will translate medical jargon into plain English, I think is what they often call it. But then if you go to presentation, it's interesting. This kind of dovetails a bit with lean medical writing, because it doesn't just mean use fancy graphs whenever you can or use bright colors or something like that. It means use things that people can understand and that really tell a story. I was working with a client and they had prepared this lay summary and they asked me to look at it. And they had this huge pie chart to show that there were 50 men and 50 women enrolled in the study. So you can imagine it was a big circle with a line right down the middle. And then they had sort of the male toilet and female toilet symbols there. And I just thought, you know, I hate to criticize a great graph, but do you really think that's an important enough point to make with a graph? Because everybody's going to look at the graphs first. So I think thinking about what you want to do as a graph and making sure people can understand it. I'm not convinced patients would understand what a Kaplan-Meier plot is or some of these things. You can't just paste something in there and think, aha. You have to really think, how do these work? How do they communicate? Is this telling what I want to tell?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And given that everybody is living in a world of information overload from every angle, it's really important to make the information that we're giving people as succinct as possible and as clear as possible. Nobody wants a lay summary or any kind of information that goes on for pages and pages and pages. So I think it's even more important to carefully consider the infographics that you're putting in there and the graphics full stop, because they take up a lot of space, which can be incredibly helpful because you can use a graphic, a well-executed graphic can save paragraphs of text and express a message much more clearly than words can. But also the reverse is true. And, you know, your example of putting a Kaplan-Meier graph in is absolutely correct. I mean, how many of the general public are actually going to really understand what that means or know how to interpret it? And in some cases, they don't even need to. So I think we have to be very careful about judging what we put in there in terms of graphics and infographics as well. Absolutely.
And this, of course, then leads to the third point, which is lay science. And I was just giving a workshop on Kaplan-Meier curves yesterday, and the point comes up about median survival that you read off a Kaplan-Meier curve. And the problem is when a doctor tells a patient, oh, median survival for someone in your case is 6 months, they think by 7 months they will be dead. What that actually means is patients in your situation in 6 months, half of them will be dead, half of them, though, will still be alive. And if you doubt whether this is an issue, go on the internet and look up median survival for patient stuff, and you'll see countless sites trying to explain it to people. And I think that's where we then move into the third part is, we need to explain maybe some very complex scientific ideas and a lot of basic stats to people who don't know what these things are. So that is a big, big part of the challenge too, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And fundamental to that is making sure that we as writers and communicators really understand that ourselves, which is easier said than done. Most of us are not trained statisticians. I know it's a special interest of yours, but for the rest of us normal humans, that's not necessarily the way our brains work. So that can be a challenge for us too. And you have to really understand something well to be able to explain it simply, I think. So when it comes to the lay language, let's start with the language side of things to begin with. What do you think are your top tips for someone who's presented with something that's very complex and would like to write it more simply? You know, you've got this paragraph of beautiful text that you've written for a regulatory audience. How would you approach then reducing that into something that would be appropriate for the general public?
That's a good question and a complex question. When I tend to look at it, I try to imagine explaining things to my grandmother. I remember when I came back from a visit when I was at university and we went somewhere, probably to church with my grandmother, and she asked me, so what are you studying? And I tried to explain her something about molecular genetics. And, you know, I started with, do you know what a gene is? And she said, no. I said, oh, do you know what a chromosome is? She said, no. I said, okay, how about a cell? She said, no. I said, okay. You may think of you as one thing, but you're actually made up of billions of little cells and all have different functions. And that, I think, was a useful experience to think, okay, how are you going to explain it to someone who really doesn't understand this stuff? And without, you know, I'd like to just jump back to a point you made, because I think it's a really good point. And that is, many writers and even medical doctors don't understand some of these concepts that well. Explaining it to patients is a whole nother level of complexity. Lisa, you mentioned about my love for statistics, and I give workshops in statistics for EMWA and DIA and so on. And often there are medical doctors in there who do not understand some of the basics of statistics. So moving past that and trying to help patients understand it is a huge challenge, because it's tempting for people like us to want to explain, you know, hypothesis testing with p-values and stuff like that. And that's not going to be effective.
Yeah, and probably not what the general public need. They don't come to the information that we're producing to be taught how to do statistics. or even taught what the different phases of clinical development are. That's not the purpose of the documents that we write. In most cases, it may well be if we're asked to write some information for the general public about how clinical development works, then obviously you'd go through the phases of clinical trial development. But in general, particularly thinking about lay summaries, the purpose of the document is not to teach the general public about clinical trials and clinical studies and how they're run. It's to explain the results of one particular study and what those results actually mean for patients, for the general public, not to explain to them what a p-value is or what statistical significance is, which is a challenge in itself, because to go to the final point of your pyramid, the lay science, trying to explain the results in a simple way without putting it into context is not fit for purpose and won't help the reader. So we have to explain the results, but then put it into the context of what these results actually mean. And that's very difficult. And actually, in my experience, changes from document to document, depending on who the target audience is, what the results actually are, and what the messaging is, what this actually means for patients. So it's never a one size fits all. It's part of what I love most about writing for these particular documents, that I don't want to use the word creative, because you're not creating anything. We're scientists first and foremost, but you do have to tap into maybe the lateral thinking part of your brain to work out, okay, how am I going to explain this to somebody who is not a specialist in my area? And I absolutely love your analogy of explaining it to your grandmother. And coincidentally, that's exactly who I picture when I am writing for the general public as well. I have one person in my mind, and it's something that I always say to every writer when I'm teaching them to write for this audience. I say, right, you need to write for a person. You're not writing for this nebulous kind of concept of someone who doesn't understand what you understand. You're writing to a person, and you need to have that person in your mind. And the closest you can have and the most detail you can have about that person, the easier I think it is to write for them, because you're starting a conversation with them. You're not just trying to lecture them or teach them. You're trying to explain things to them. And I think there's a big difference in that.
I agree. And that sounds great. And I would even add to that, I think this is maybe the biggest challenge and the biggest difference to regulatory documents. Because in regulatory documents, you basically have to provide everything and you have to help the reviewers find things. You can't present everything. And in fact, you have to be very judicious on what things you present and how they present them. And that already makes most medical writers feel very uncomfortable, because they're thinking, oh, you know, should we leave this out? And I have given talks on this, most notably at DIA, where patient advocacy representatives have shown up and criticized me when I said, you can't put everything. And they say, so you're going to run tests on humans that you won't tell us about? And I was like, well, it wasn't quite what I was thinking. but, you know, and it's really interesting. And I think that also ties in with what you said about, you know, diversity of audience, and it needs to be a dialogue. We do need to talk to patient advocacy groups. You know, most notably, I had this fight when I said we should only present the primary objective because it's the only one with statistical power. And then I got those kind of responses. And I said, well, how are you going to explain to the lay public or the general public, you know, what statistical power means and how that affects your conclusion? And they said, fair enough, but we sometimes don't care about the primary objective. We have other measures that we're more interested in. The classic is progression-free survival of a tumor compared to overall survival. And that's when I began to think, you know, this is probably not a bad idea that pharma companies involve patient groups and patient advocacy representatives in planning their study. And maybe in addition to a primary objective, which has statistical power, you could have a most relevant patient objective, which is something that matters a lot to patients and that they really care about. You're still going to have the problem of explaining the statistical power, but I think that's, you know, this whole idea of making it a dialogue and choosing what to present and how to present it. And I love the word you use, creativity. It seems odd in this field, yeah, but that's exactly what you need, is to be creative, to come up with creative ways, good metaphors and stuff to explain these things. That's a crucial tool. And I totally agree.
Absolutely. And it's kind of the fun bit of it as well. I think it's when you find that perfect way of explaining something that's quite complex, it's a proper buzz. And I know I'm sounding like a proper medical writing nerd, and I am. But yeah, I love that. I think that's great because it's a real value add. I feel like I've really helped somebody in a real way, which I think sometimes in our world is we're a bit one step removed. So it's hard to feel that sometimes. I love what you said about involving patients earlier and earlier in the process. And I know that the FDA and the EMA both have transparency initiatives and patient centricity initiatives to try and encourage that. So I think we're a way away from it at the minute, but we're definitely pushing on an open door. And it's been adopted by the industry to different levels. I know that most pharmaceutical companies now have somebody whose job it is to look at patient engagement and patient involvement. Which is a great step forward, I think. And they are, as far as they're allowed, are able to engage with patient advocacy groups and patient representatives, which I think is fantastic. From what we've seen, certainly with our clients, I think we're a little step away from involving patients at protocol creation stage, which is a bit of a shame. I'd like to see more of that because I think just the example that you gave, I think that would be really, really helpful. And certainly my experience of reaching out to patient advocacy groups or patient representatives has been overwhelmingly positive. I've never had a negative experience of that. And I would definitely encourage all medical writers to do that if they were, you know, unsure of perhaps how a patient group likes to be referred to or how they should approach writing for a particular patient group. I think that's incredibly helpful. In terms of the storytelling, the messaging, Barry, I know that you've talked quite a lot and you're a great advocate of lean medical writing. How does that apply to writing for the general public, do you think? Does it translate across?
Well, absolutely. And in my various talks and things and articles about lean medical writing, I make the difference between it's not just fat versus thin. We all know what fat medical writing is, just way too much numbers, text, and the rest. Thin would be a lot less. And that's as good as far as it goes. But actually, what you really want is lean. I have a great graphic for this, as you can imagine, where you want it more muscular to tell a story. And it's not just using fewer words. It's really getting to the gist of it. And I think that is something that would apply just as well to writing for the general public. I went in when I started doing this, looking up various internet sites about writing for the general public. And many of them said things like, keep it short, keep it simple, tell a story. And I kind of laughed because I thought that's not actually bad advice for regulatory writing either. So I think, yeah, that telling a story is what really should be at the back of all of our minds as we do this, not just dumbing it down, as you said, but telling a story and maybe leaving out the things that are interesting but aren't that really relevant to patients. And part of that, as you said, and I'm thrilled to hear what you say, because you obviously know more about this than I do, about the regulatory movement to involve patients better. I also, though, totally agree with you that they need to be involved at the protocol level, because that's where those decisions are made. Once things have been made, it's more difficult to do that. And that would finally lead me to a point I want to just throw in here. You were talking about the buzz of being a medical writer, and that's okay, but you have to admit, it's not like we're writing Stephen King novels that half the world's going to read. You know, we write things that get read by a very small number of people and then never again. And here's an opportunity to do it differently. And I think that is really crucial for the pharma industry. And I think the best evidence of that comes from the recent coronavirus pandemic, where almost no one seemed to know what was going on or how clinical trials worked or what's involved in getting a vaccine. And I was being deluged with questions, and I just couldn't believe when people would say, well, what about this? Why can't we have it tomorrow? I was like, hey, you know, this stuff takes time and you have to do trials. And they say, well, here's one trial and here's another trial. Can we compare? And I'm like, no, you can't. You have to do it within a single thing. So I think, and this is going very broad brush, but yeah, it's very important for the pharmaceutical industry and civilization in general, I will be so grandiose to say, that we start explaining clinical research and clinical trials and the development of new medicines better to the public than we have done so far. And I think one of the key tools in that are lay summaries.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Lay summaries and just information in general aimed at the non-specialist audience. And I was sitting here smiling as you were talking about the coronavirus pandemic. I think I've never been more popular among my friends, or my job has never been more exciting to them than when the pandemic hit, and all of a sudden there were all of these questions and they didn't understand what the government was putting out there, or the graphs that they put up. And I was getting texts on an hourly basis saying, can you explain what this is and what's the difference between these vaccine types and what's mRNA? And yeah, I became very, very popular all of a sudden. Clearly, I've gone back to living under a rock again now because everyone's had their jab and they're not so excited about it anymore. But yeah, for a while, I was a bit of a rock star around here, which was very unusual and very nice.
Well, what surprised me about this, sorry to interrupt, but is I have been working on an AI software, which Julie and I have discussed in another Trilla Talks. But they are all very intelligent people, all with high university degrees, you know, programmers and stuff. But I was amazed at how little they do about clinical research, because being involved in clinical research myself and dealing with people like Lisa, who know tons about clinical research, a lot of this stuff you just take for granted. But they didn't know what a placebo control was or why it was worth doing. And I would explain it and they'd say, oh, that's a good idea. And I would kind of laugh, but also think, gosh, you know, the pharma industry has just done an appalling job of explaining what they're doing and why to everyone, basically, who's not involved in it. And this is something partially through lay summaries and partially through other things. And we may be doing a Trilla Talk sometime in the future where we look at other kinds of writing, patient pamphlets and treatment explanations and stuff like that, internet sites, where we all need to do just a much better job and get out of this, you know, writing, very narrow writing for FDA kind of mindset that we have, or EMA that we have.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's been very difficult for the pharmaceutical industry because the codes of conduct have meant that they've largely had their arms tied behind their back. And, you know, if you're not allowed to engage directly with the public, certainly in the UK and the EU, it's different in America, obviously. There's very little incentive for them to go down this route and try and do it well because they're not allowed to anyway. So I have some sympathy for it. It's meant that we've ended up in a not too great place, to be honest. I love the point that you raised about it's never about somebody being intelligent or not intelligent. It's not about general intelligence. And when I'm teaching writers about this, I always use the analogy about me taking my car to the garage. I don't think I'm a particularly stupid person, but I know absolutely nothing about engines. And the mechanics love to come out and talk about carburetors and shafts and wheels and belts and all sorts of things. And quite honestly, it goes straight over my head. I have no idea what they're talking about. And it's not because I'm stupid. It's because they're using a language that I just don't understand. And no one has ever explained it to me. Nobody's described to me how an engine works. So I have no idea what they're telling me and what that means. I have no context to put that into to be able to understand and to do anything with the information that they're giving me. They give me tons of information, but they may as well not bother because I don't know what to do with it. And it's the same thing with health information. And it goes back to something called health literacy and health numeracy. And health literacy is the ability to use and take information related to healthcare and medicines and to process it and to use that. And there is nothing to do with general intelligence. It has something to do with general reading levels. Obviously, if you're providing written information, how well you can physically read does affect your health literacy. But it's nothing to do with how intelligent you are, how clever you are, or anything on that side of things. So it should never be about dumbing down or making things for somebody who's less intelligent. The general public are not less intelligent or stupid or any of those things. They just don't have the same kind of training. And health numeracy is the same thing, just related to numbers, which I know will be a particular pet topic of yours, Barry, with your love of numbers and statistics. But health numeracy levels are even lower because for some reason, and it's not just in the UK, this is global, we are really bad at maths. People just don't do numbers. Globally, we don't. So we're better at reading than we are at using numbers. So it's doubly difficult when you're trying to explain numbers, which you have to for context, and that's how the results are presented, trying to present numbers to a lay audience or the general public. because how they process those numbers are very, very different. And that comes down to presentation. I think it feeds back to that story you had at the very start about a pie chart that was half blue and half pink, and they were trying to show 50%, which is, yeah, a bit insane. But there are other issues. So trying to present negatives is a particular problem. I've seen many graphs that they have things going below the zero axis, and that causes all kinds of confusion and normally leads to questions like from the public, a reviewer saying, why have you put the graph in upside down? Because most of the general public expect graphs to just go one way. They're not expecting graphs to go downwards. What are the considerations for presentation do you think about when you're teaching, or especially because I know you teach a lot on data presentation. So what are the general top tips you would give writers when they're thinking about making something as easy to understand and as simple as they can in terms of data presentation?
Well, I had a couple of thoughts as you were talking. One, which we're not going to go into here because it's a whole separate topic about absolving the pharma industry for responsibility for not explaining things to patients. I am a little less understanding than you are. I wanted to point that out, though, so people don't think you and I agree on everything. But as to the presentations, I think, you know, just to give you a good example, percentages are often very poorly understood by people and poorly presented. I've seen percentage graphs where the bottom is 90% and the top is 100%, which makes a difference of 94 versus 92 look gigantic. And that's ludicrous. And percentages always have to go to zero because it's a part of 100. So I think things like that are real challenges. And you need, as we mentioned earlier, to think of the story. What is the story? What do I want to say? And I think, you know, that has just been so exciting for me teaching lean medical writing, where I try to get writers to stop saying, here are the numbers, and say, what do the numbers mean? You know, 94%, 92%. Do you think that's a difference? Well, yes or no? Not really. Okay, then say that. Rather than just saying 94 or 92, you decide. There was even this myth that FDA preferred you never made a comment. And I said, that's ridiculous. You know, you have to say whether you think that's a relevant difference and whether you'd see it being repeated. So those are, I think, the kinds of issues that we probably should be doing for a lot of regulatory writing anyway, but even more so for the public. And I see this as a necessary cattle prod, maybe, to the industry to just move in general better in this direction. Because I think it'll pay dividends also in terms of acceptance for the pharma industry. As Lisa, I'm sure you know, when you admit to people on the train or in the airport that you work for the pharma industry, they all tend to kind of move over to another part of the building. Yes. Or the train. And, you know, and I think a lot of that comes from unfair headlines, fair enough, but a lot of it comes from nobody really knows what's going on.
Yes.
And I think this is part of helping to explain that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it can only be a good thing for everybody involved to have more transparency and more interaction with the general public from the pharma industry side of things. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, misconceptions, and from that comes, you know, the side of things that people are mistrusting and believe that the pharma just want to profit out of misery. So Barry, it's been really, really lovely speaking with you this morning. Thank you very much,
Lisa,
for your time and your insights. Thank you all for listening to Trialer Talk today. If you've enjoyed it, please come back and listen to us again. If you have feedback on this or on any of our sessions, we really would love to hear it. So please do reach out to us. If you have ideas for future topics you'd like us to cover, please let us know. I'm sure that either we can cover it or we can find somebody to talk to who can cover it for you. So very interested in hearing from you on that. And you can send us comments on our Twitter feed, on our LinkedIn page. And just a reminder that you can find all of our episodes of the Trialer Talk podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and trilogywriting.com/Trialer Talk. Just to wet your whistle, we've got some upcoming Trialer Talks that will be on apprenticing medical writers, ethics of medical writing, which is bound to be a very interesting one. Barry, I know you're involved in that, so that will be great. And things like responses to regulatory authorities and more about writing for the general public. So please do join us back on Trialer Talk, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Barry.